Hello, and welcome to episode 106 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. Aside from Bill and I, we have a special guest today whom many of you listeners have probably heard of or at least seen, but I'll let Bill do the formal introduction of our guest and our topic. Bill, take it away.
Thanks, Seth. If the two of us were to define the two main thrusts of our podcast, the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War, it would be one, to correct some of the mythology that has emerged over the decades, and two, to see what lessons might be gleaned that could be important were war to break out in the Pacific again. In my view, our subject for today falls into the second category because it's about the impact of strategic alignment and chains of command on operational success. Station Hypo was one of three main stations in the Navy used to listen and break Japanese naval codes. Hypo was the phonetic word for the letter H, which stood for Hawaii, since Station Hypo was the code-breaking office located in the basement of the Hawaii Naval District Commander's Building in Pearl Harbor. As an aside, I visited those rooms when I was Commodore in Pearl, and they were being used to store furniture for the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard Headquarters Building, but we'll leave that for another potential future discussion on what's happening to all these historic sites over the decades. But germane to today's conversation, in the early months of the war, the Naval District Hawaii Commander reported not to Admiral Nimitz, but to Admiral King directly. That would be corrected in the coming months, but since Station Hypo supported combat operations in the Pacific, Admiral Nimitz certainly thought of it as one of his assets, while Admiral King's staff in Washington saw it solely and completely theirs, to include Station Hypo's brilliant leader, Commander Joe Rochefort. This led to a chain of command problem that would ultimately lead to Rochefort's dismissal as the head of Station Hypo, even after his incredible success leading to our victory at Midway. Sorry for the long-winded introduction, but to help us unpack all of this, to include how Station Hypo fed both King's and Nimitz's strategic insight, we are proud to host the Chief Historian of the Navy and the Director of Naval History and Heritage Command, retired Rear Admiral Sam Cox. Admiral Cox, welcome.
Good morning, good afternoon. Great to see you.
Thanks, Admiral.
So as we're going to break it down, Admiral and Bill, you just jump in at any time. Let's talk about Station Hypo before we get to Admiral King. We're going to talk about him as well. But what exactly was Station Hypo? Bill hit on it a bit on his introduction, but what was it exactly? What was the role of Hypo? Where did it start? How did it begin? And where are its roots in World War II in the Pacific Theater?
Well, yes, Station Hypo was created in the late 1930s, and it did more than code breaking. It did traffic analysis. It did kind of general intelligence. It eventually had a term for it of the Combat Intelligence Unit. But it was embedded within the communications architecture of the 14th Naval District, which fell under Admiral Claude Bloch. Rochefort had a second hat, or actually his primary hat was essentially as the N6 or the communications officer for the 14th Naval District. And then under him was this code breaking, traffic analysis, communications. At the time, it was referred to as radio intelligence. We would now call it, communications intelligence. But he had a small team that grew in the pre-war era. In fact, by about March of 1941, that group was going 24 hours, 7 days a week, which was highly unusual at that time. Out of anticipation that the war was going to break out in the Pacific. But Rochefort was the senior officer in command of Station Hypo, which had this intercept, code-breaking, traffic analysis capability. And technically, his chain led to Op 20G, which was in Washington, D.C., which fell under Naval Communications. There had been a food fight in the 1930s over, you know, who owned communications intelligence, Naval Communications or Naval Intelligence. Communications had won that argument up to that point. And so all of this fell under the rubric of, you know, Naval Communications, and that reported to the Chief Naval Operations. So if you follow the train, Rochefort reports to Admiral Block, who reports to the CNO, before King was both CNO and the Commander Chief of U.S. Fleet. And under the CNO was the Naval Communications. And so day-to-day communications was supposed to go between Station Hypo and Op 20G, which became, also had a call sign, which was NEGIT, which was N for Navy at that time.
Admiral, there's one of the things that we try to do with the podcast is destroy mythology. And one of the myths that you see bouncing around the internet is the myth that, well, since Hypo was a code-breaking station, they would have had access to the diplomatic code and particularly the message that informed the Japanese ambassador in Washington that talks were breaking down. Ergo, they would have known that an attack was imminent. And what's wrong with that theory?
Actually, there's a whole bunch of things wrong with that theory. One of which is that Station Hypo was tasked by Washington, by Op 20G, to attempt to break the Japanese flag officer's code and not the operational what became later known as JN-25, at the time was known as the 5NUM code because it was five, you know, digits in each group. And the flag officer's code was never broken because there was never enough traffic on it for the cryptologists to really get into it. So essentially, prior to Pearl Harbor, Station Hypo was in effect wasting their time on this unbreakable code. Station Cast, which was in the Philippines, was assigned to try to work the JN-25, you know, operational code along with Washington. And they were having some success, maybe reading 10%, but even that is not certain, probably less than that. The other piece is that the diplomatic code was separate from the operational code. Japanese military had no use for their diplomats. So anything that was operational was not going to be found in the diplomatic codes, which was called purple because of the book that, you know, is a purple book that we had and later term magic. But, you know, in Washington, D.C., the Navy and Air Army were taking turns. One day the Army would break the purple code, the next day the others. And we had devised a machine to break that code. So we're actually reading the purple code faster than the Japanese embassy was. In fact, we knew when the messages came in that told them to break off diplomatic relations and what time they were supposed to do it. We knew that before the Japanese, you know, embassy did. Station Hypo never had a purple machine. They were not read into it. In about July of 1941, a couple messages, purple messages, got sent to Hypo by accident. So both Rochefort and Kimmel suspected there was information and intelligence that they weren't getting, and they asked to get it. And then in best what appears to be just pure bureaucratic buffoonery, you know, the CNO asked, well, are they getting it? And he was told they were. No one checked. And actually, they weren't getting. Everyone assumed that Hypo was getting this purple traffic, but they weren't.
Mm-hmm. And this would have been Admiral Stark as CNO at this time?
That's correct, yeah.
Before King became both Comminch and CNO. Understand.
And let me just say that bureaucratic buffoonery might be my favorite phrase that's been uttered on this podcast so far, because if that isn't the truth,
there was a lot of it.
Yeah, but you're not lying. So like you said, Admiral, they're reading maybe 10% of the Japanese code prior to Pearl Harbor. And what causes them to be able to decipher more? I mean, it's an amount of traffic that's coming through right after Pearl, is it not?
That's correct. What really helps them is the carrier raids that take place in basically February and March of 1942. Station Hypo was able to tell a lot by what's called traffic analysis, you know, analysis of the externals of a message without actually being able to read the contents, you know, the from to precedents. And by doing that kind of work, they were able to have a fairly good idea where Japanese carriers were and where they weren't, or where a major operation was going to take place, at least enough to know, give when Admiral Nimitz took command of the Pacific Fleet, and they started launching these carrier raids, they had a reasonable idea that the Japanese carriers weren't there. Right. So our forces could do these raids without fear of running into a major Japanese carrier force. But every time we did a raid like that, Japanese message traffic on the net would explode, and you'd get a lot of traffic, and there'd be mistakes in terms of how they handled the messages. And it was those kinds of mistakes plus the volume of traffic that would allow a code breaker more material to work with, more opportunity to see patterns that are taking place within the traffic. So each one of those carrier raids, one, convinced Nimitz that the intelligence, particularly the traffic analysis, was fairly accurate. And then as they broke more and more of the operational code, also convinced Nimitz that, hey, this is a reliable, valuable source of information that he could actually use to conduct operations.
We covered the carrier raids in a previous episode, Admiral, and we did talk about both the radio direction finding and the traffic analysis that indicated that the carriers, the Japanese carriers, were out of position to be able to affect directly, you know, our carrier raids, which was really great. And that's one example of how Hypo was able to affect our strategy, or at least reinforce the notion that the strategic choices that were being made by Nimitz with pressure from King were going to succeed at some level. There's this perception in the public, though, that Hypo's contributions towards strategic framework and objectives peaked with Midway and then declined after that. Is that fair?
No. Obviously, in Midway being the turning point of the war, although you can make a case that the campaign around Guadalcanal was a real turning point, but and I would argue it Guadalcanal is. But the I lost my train of thought on that one. Can you run the question by me again?
Yeah, they you know, everybody knows about the success in Midway, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. The code breaking starts to really blossom in, you know, April of 1942. And they get the Station Hypo is able to break enough of the Japanese code to understand that Operation MO is the attempt by the Japanese to take Port Moresby, and that there's going to be a Japanese force that doesn't include all of their aircraft carriers that's going into the Coral Sea. And so Station Hypo and all, you know, everyone talks about Rochefort, but actually the intelligence officer for the Pacific Fleet is Eddie Layton is the conduit between Rochefort and Nimitz, which is another interesting story in itself. But Layton is adding not just the code breaking and the signals intelligence, but also human intelligence, reconnaissance, all kinds of.
He's the fusion, the one-man fusion center, isn't he?
Exactly. and he's the one who's convincing. And Nimitz is convinced that, hey, there's a big operation going to take place in the Coral Sea. And he sends Yorktown and Lexington down there to intercept. He wanted to send Hornet and Enterprise too, but they're already committed to the Doolittle raid. And when that raid takes off, both those ships are then sent down to the Coral Sea, but they don't get there in time for the battle. So the fact that the Battle of the Coral Sea happens at all is no accident. It's a result of the code-breaking intelligence that convinces Nimitz to put forces there to oppose this Japanese, you know, operation. And then they have the Midway, and we'll probably get into that in more detail. But the Japanese would change their codes periodically, and they changed just before Midway, a few days before the operation, which was one, an indicator that something big is going down, which took a while for Station Hypo to reconstruct what they had in April and May. And so the early parts of the Guadalcanal campaign, the intelligence from code breaking is not as good as it was at Coral Sea and Midway. It gets better to the point where when they intercept Admiral Yamamoto's, right, you know, aircraft in the air and shoot him down is one of the other highlights of what Station, you know, Hypo was able to do. But, you know, Japanese communication security was actually pretty good, you know, even with, you know, code breaking efforts. So it's a constant seesaw battle between the code breakers and the operation security of the Japanese. And sometimes we're really good and sometimes we're not. It all depends on when you look at that point on the spectrum.
I want to get back to the point, Admiral, you made earlier, and it's 100% so true. The people don't, you know, people think that we were literally reading the Japanese mail, you know, from day one. And that's just not how it was. The traffic analysis, which allowed us to launch the carrier raids in February and March and everything. And that was the real main point of an intel for the Pacific Fleet was that traffic analysis, so much so that some of the people in Hypo could recognize the fists of the Japanese messengers. Is that not true?
Yeah, that's true. And in some cases, you could actually recognize, you know, the Morse code interceptors could actually tell who was on the Japanese side. You know, each guy, when you're, right, when you're doing the thing, has a essentially a signature, and they could track, you know, individuals and know, you know, in some cases know what ship.
Right.
But yeah, traffic analysis was actually probably the biggest producer of the intelligence. The code breaking helped fill in gaps, but there was also a lot missing in the key because, yeah, you know, Admiral Nimitz did not have the Japanese op order for Midway, right, beforehand. Right. You know, he knew the date to within about 2 days. He knew approximately the number of carriers that were going to be involved, you know, 4 or 5. And he knew the target was Midway and not a whole lot else.
And but Leighton was able to glean like the bearing, the heading that they'd be coming in at within 5 degrees. And
oh, yeah. You know, Leighton got pressed to, because what Nimitz had charged Leighton to do was because Leighton and Rosbert were both in the same jobs for Pearl Harbor, which is like the biggest disaster, you know, in U.S. naval history. And so you have these same two guys who are also the victors of the Battle Midway. You know, when Nimitz comes in, you know, Leighton goes, boss, you know, send me to the fleet. And Nimitz tells him no. And actually, Nimitz doesn't fire anybody off of Kimmel's staff, and he doesn't yell, he doesn't scream, he doesn't, you know, very interesting leadership example there. But you know, he tells Leighton that I want you to get into Yamamoto's head, who's commander chief of the Japanese combined fleet. I want you to think like Yamamoto, because Leighton's a Japanese linguist, as is Rochefort, had time in Japan, both as a linguist student and as the assistant naval attaché. So he's got this, you know, better understanding of the Japanese than just about anyone else. And so Leighton gets pressed, no, I want you to tell me exactly when and where we're going to find the Japanese. And, you know, Leighton squirms at first, is like, I don't have that level. And he gets pressed to do it. And he says, okay, it's going to be on the 4th of June. At I forget the exact time, but like 0600 on course, you know, 355 from Midway at a certain range. And it turned out that he was, well, supposedly the story is 5 degrees, 5 minutes and five miles, you know, off.
Off, yeah.
You know, actually, when you do time changes, actually, the Japanese were a day late from their plan. But when Leighton came up with his date, he factored in the weather, and the Japanese hadn't.
So one of when the 1976, I think it was, movie Midway came out, was, in my view, atrocious. Leighton was, Rochefort was actually a technical advisor to the movie. He died before it was released. And you have this character, Hal Holbrook, portraying him as a almost a Southern drawl kind of eccentric, bathrobe wearing country boy. And it was interesting to me. This is one of those myths that have been continued through the years. That wasn't him at all, was it?
Actually, Rochefort was pretty straight-laced. The Hal Holbrook interpretation has, you know, taken hold.
It has.
But he really wasn't like that at all. He did wear a smoking jacket down in the dungeon because it was cold. He did wear slippers because it's a concrete floor and it's cold and it's hard on the feet. And they are all down there popping uppers during this whole thing. So I don't think they show that in the 75 movie, but they do show it in the 2019. That portrayal is closer, but you know what Rochefort did not have going for him was that he was not an Academy graduate.
Right.
But he also wasn't Naval Reserve either.
Former enlisted.
Yeah, right. He wasn't even a high school
graduate. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You know, so he's different than everybody else. But you know, he essentially rises through the ranks on merit by, you know, impressing people like, you know, Admiral Richardson by his abilities, because he's got nothing else, you know, going for him. It catches up with him in the end, where he gets in a food fight with a bunch of, you know, ring knocking CAD graduates,
the Redmond brothers.
And a few others. He was brilliant. So was Leighton. The two of them had gone on the same ship to Japan together. They'd studied in different places, but they knew each other well, and they were actually close friends. So the whole linkage, both before Pearl Harbor and before Midway, of Rochefort going to Leighton to first Kimmel and then Nimitz, is kind of, you know, under the table, you know, good old boy relationship that's outside the chain of command, you know, if you will, which also eventually caught up to Rochefort, but he had the advantage of being right. That was a personal relationship between Rochefort and Leighton that really made the difference in Midway, and didn't make the difference in Pearl Harbor. But we can go on about what led to that in great detail.
Sure.
Well, it's during Rochefort's tenure was not your normal naval assignment. You know, it was a different place, not just because of the cryptanalyst, that's hard to say, not just because of the code breaking, but because of the man who ran it. And you got into it a little bit, Admiral, but you know, I mean, these guys are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the time.
To pick his staff. I mean,
he did.
When I was CEO or Commodore, I didn't get to pick my staff. I mean, it really was a different kind of command, wasn't it?
It was. One thing to consider at the time is, you know, there is no such thing as an intelligence officer or a cryptologist, or they're all line officers. And, you know, in order to get promoted, you have to go to sea and do the things that line officers do. Now, a small number of officers would have essentially, if you would call it today's terms, a subspecialty, you know, where they would spend, you know, one or two, maybe more tours in an intelligence or communications intelligence, you know, assignment. If you did too many of those, you're going to kill your career. It was not career enhancing. You know, like battleships did have an intelligence officer when they weren't being the laundry officer, and I'm not kidding on that. So there's this very small number of officers and some senior enlisted that have these multiple tours in intelligence and cryptology. And so when Station Hypo forms up, you know, the first officer in charge, you know, winds up eventually working for Rochefort. Rochefort comes in and is more senior. But there's he's able to pick and choose and, you know, hey, why don't you so-and-so come here? Because you actually have some experience, you know, doing this. So Rochefort was not the code breaker. Right. You know, he was in charge of code breakers. He had experience in it. He understood it. But he had people working for him like Jasper Holmes, Laswell. Those were the people who were actually breaking the codes.
Thomas Dyer, Lieutenant Commander Dyer.
Yeah, him too.
He was what they said, you know. Right before we started recording, I mentioned to Bill that I knew Admiral Max Showers, who worked for Rochefort at Hypo during this time period. And he mentioned Dyer, and he said that Dyer was probably of all of them, he was the most gifted code breaker. Like he could stare at something for days and pick out the little nuances and different things that were in the message and glean things from that that really seemingly nobody else could. So as you said, it wasn't just Rochefort. He had a hell of a team in there that were doing this work.
One of the myths is that they had the California band, you know, working in there because of their musical ability might help them with the basics of code breaking. They did have the California band in there, but because their ship was sunk, they had nothing. It was a pure manpower issue. It had nothing to do with whether their musical talent would be more helpful in code breaking operations.
They were walking around messages and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, they did great work, but, you know, it wasn't code breaking.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was like kind of like that all over the fleet, though, at that time, too. I mean, you know, you had these battleships that all of a sudden are, you know, useless. And you got crew, where do they go? And everybody needs manpower. It just so happened that the whole band was plopped from the battleship California into Station Hypo.
When one of those deals that, let me say this, we did an episode on Nimitz already. And, you know, I'm still amazed at the degree to which he was able to herd the cats, to use the modern expression, right? And get all of these various personalities, some really big egos pulling in the same direction, with the exception of MacArthur, but that's another story. It's difficult to find any failing when you examine Nimitz's, you know, leadership of the Pacific Ocean area region. The one thing I can maybe kind of fault him for was not working more aggressively to save Rochefort when he came in conflict with Admiral King's staff, who was at the time was CNO, and the Redmond brothers, and again Rochefort's own personal style of very in your face, very confrontational, didn't do him any favors. However, Nimitz knew that the Rochefort Layton team had, in fact, he put him in for Distinguished Service Medal, which King disapproved. Why do you think Nimitz didn't work harder to protect Rochefort from these guys, the bureaucratic buffoonery, to use your expression, back in Washington?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a good question. You know, my view is that Nimitz had bigger fish to fry. I mean, you know, when you get towards the end of the war and you're you know, you've got kamikazes and atom bombs, and I mean, there's huge issues that he's dealing with, and to get that down in the weeds as an award for a commander, you know, later captain at the end of the war. But he may not have even known that thing was going on, you know, until actually once when he found out in later life, you know, he felt it was a disservice to Rochefort.
Well, I know that Nimitz did, he was express his outrage,
displeasure,
that Rochefort was reassigned without anybody consulting him. you know, but again, do you think it was professional, the Rochefort's administrative chain of command, as you said, went through Washington, through director of communications, or you know, in OPNAV, OP-02G, was one of the captain Redmond's, right?
Right.
Do you think it was merely professional jealousy that caused them to be so against Rochefort, or was there something legitimate behind all of this?
Well, you know, there is the, you know, not using the chain of command, you know, is a real issue. I'm convinced there was professional jealousy involved. Mm-hmm. There was also, you know, a move, you know, in Washington, D.C. to centralize code breaking cryptology, in, you know, to operate it from a centralized position. And right after Pearl Harbor, where, you know, I don't buy the Roosevelt knew, you know, conspiracy, but there was a massive cover your behind going on and blame shifting mm-hmm. going on. And you had probably the best cryptologist, you know, in the Navy, who was Lawrence Safford, you know, gets sidelined out of his job because, well, you're, you know, Pearl Harbor is partly your fault, you know. And you have the Redmond brothers, you know, one takes Safford's place, one is the head of the Naval Communications. Neither one of us have much knowledge at all about code breaking or trafficking out or any of that. And it turned out that they were dead wrong about, you know, what the Japanese intentions were at, you know, the famous, you know, AF gambit, if mm-hmm. you will.
Yeah, Midway. Right. Yeah.
Where they're trying to, you know, the code breakers have figured out that, you know, Station Hypo believes that AF stands for Midway. Mm-hmm. But Washington doesn't.
Strenuously disagrees, even the Army, right?
Yeah, Rochefort and Layton have already convinced Nimitz that AF is Midway. They're not trying to prove it. They're trying to prove that AF is Midway to Washington.
Right.
The 2019 movie gets that a lot better than the one in the
70s,
1975. But that whole, you know, sending a message to Midway via the underwater cable to send a message in the clear that their desalination plant, you know, blew up and they need water, and then have the Japanese intercept that and then have that go out in their traffic to verify that AF is that. That was all to convince Washington. And even then, King was still not convinced, and he mm-hmm. wanted direct from Rochefort his assessment of the situation before he finally kind of reluctantly agreed with Nimitz, who had already believed what Rochefort was saying. Mm-hmm.
To what extent do you believe that the hypo intercepts and traffic analysis directly affected the strategic campaign in the Pacific beyond Midway?
I think it's huge. You know, Coral Sea wouldn't have happened without it, in which case there would have been six carriers against, you know, maybe our four. That might have, you know, Nimitz might have taken that chance. You know, they still underestimated what the Japanese were capable of doing when Nimitz decided to do. We got lucky in some respects. We had the advantage of surprise, had the advantage of position. Japanese were overconfident, you know, all kinds of things going against them. But we came within a hair's breadth of losing that battle.
Oh, right.
In fact, I can like change one thing of, you know, Nautilus getting hit and knocked out of the battle that would change the whole course and result Absolutely. In a U.S. defeat.
Then the airplanes would not have found the carriers.
As
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, but anyway, you know, if it hadn't been for that, the code breaking, I don't think one Nimitz wouldn't have known that Midway was the target, and he probably wouldn't have been able to react to it. So, I think it was huge. Changed the course of the war.
Oh, there's no doubt. And I mean, I think that's something that people don't understand is, and that's what we're trying to do here on this particular episode is the importance that they played all through the war, but especially in that first 6-7-8 month period of the Pacific War, because I mean we were so grossly underperforming, frankly. You know, we really were, we as a Navy, as a military force, were so grossly underperforming until that lucky strike at Midway, and that these guys were the ones that were able to allow us to be in that position or those positions to inflict the blows that eventually did start the turn. I agree with you 100%. Midway was not the turning point. It was Guadalcanal. But without Midway, there would have been no Guadalcanal. And without Rochefort and Hypo, there would have been no Midway. There would have been no Coral Sea. So their importance in the Pacific War is incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I could make a case that you'll get argument, you know, on this between different historians. I think it was Arthur Schlesinger, you know, who made the case that the Battle of Midway affected not just the Pacific, but the entire war and the entire post-war environment that resulted. And the argument goes like this, you know, is after Pearl Harbor, the American people were mad at Japan. They wanted at Japan. The grand strategy under Roosevelt Churchill was defeat Germany first.
Europe first. Yep.
Yeah. And for a whole lot of reasons, if we had lost the Battle of Midway, the pressure on Roosevelt to do something about them could have stalled the operations in Europe. And you could have had the operations where probably not likely that, but you know, conceive that, okay, if you delayed the invasion of Normandy, like the British kept wanting to do, until the Germans get an atom bomb, or more likely the Soviet Red Army is camped out in France, you have changed the whole course of history as a result of losing the Battle of Midway. Other historians will, you know, this, the what if history, you know, kind of, you know, is frowned upon, but, you know, it's conceivable, but regardless, the impact was huge. You're right. There would have been no Guadalcanal. Right. Without Midway.
And your point, though, I mean, you bring up the point that King, this is an unauthorized history of the Pacific War, but King had to worry about both theaters. And the Europe First policy could have overwhelmed the Pacific Fleet if King didn't work so aggressively to make sure everyone was on board with the need to work our way in the Pacific, right, in parallel. And so, you know, that was huge as far as delaying operations could have been catastrophic for a lot of what we needed to do in the Pacific.
Yeah, I mean, you know, King, you know, contrary to myth, was, you know, the Anglophobe is overplayed. You know, he was just abrasive to everybody,
including Eisenhower.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Eisenhower, in his diary, thinks you know, King is stupid. Right. King doesn't have a very high opinion of Eisenhower either. It's interesting to you know, see the two of them. But King supported the Germany First plan. What his issue was is that while the British are delaying invading Normandy, he said, well, if you're not going to use this stuff, in the Pacific. Yeah. Well, you know, and it's like he goes, you know, the Pacific should be getting 30% of the old thing, but we're only getting 15%. You know, I want the whole 30%. And that's kind of what Guadalcanal was about, was to put a stake in the ground, put the offensive out there and a claim on resources. It's like, if you don't give me these ships and aircraft, we're going to lose, you know, the battle. And we came close to it, but it was part of get resources flowing to the Pacific. The JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, was against the Guadalcanal campaign, as was just about everybody, because we were not logistically ready to do it. You know, the official name was Operation Watchtower, but everyone there called it Operation Shoestring. And it really was a near run thing, but that was King's strategy, was to, you know, get some stuff going to the Pacific rather than waiting around and not using it in the Atlantic. Well, in Europe, we were having a good old fight against submarines in the Atlantic.
With the time we have left, we got about 15-ish, 20 minutes left, Admiral. Let's talk about Admiral King. That's somebody that Bill and I have hit on through every episode that we've done. We've at least mentioned his name once, and we've mentioned it several times today. So he's give us a little bio on King right at Pearl Harbor. What how does he get to the position in which he is, and what kind of a cat was Admiral Ernest King?
Well, at the time of Pearl Harbor, King is the commander in chief of the U.S. Atlantic Fleet, which had been upgraded to a 4-star fleet command earlier in 1941. When he first got there, he was a 3-star, and it was the Atlantic Squadron. Kimmel in the Pacific was the commander in chief of the Pacific Fleet, but also commander in chief of the U.S. Fleet, which is, you know, the entire U.S. fleet.
Sink us.
Yeah, you know, that was the acronym. And when King took that title, he quickly changed it to Comage. And then there was another 4-star out in Asia, the commander-in-chief of the Asiatic Fleet. But the one in the Pacific had this overarching, you know, hat. Well, when Kimmel gets relieved about 17th of December, 41, there's a temporary Admiral Pai, who's the battle force commander, 3-star, takes temporary command of the Pacific Fleet. The U.S. fleet is kind of up in the air for a few days. When Nimitz comes out, he takes command, and that's about December 27, right after Christmas. You know, he takes the Pacific Fleet hat, but the commander-in-chief U.S. fleet goes to King. So even though King is off in Norfolk, he's now got the fleet operations for both the Pacific and the Atlantic, you know, under his purview. And by about March, he takes over the chief naval operations hat too. So he's the only one to ever have, you know, that combination of, you know, power across, you know, both the man, train, equip, and the operations of the entire, you know, U.S. Navy basically fall under him.
And is that when Nimitz also becomes Commander-in-Chief Pacific Ocean Areas?
Yeah, that's a little later, but when they jointify, the Pacific Ocean Area is a joint command, whereas the Pacific Fleet was the Navy command, you know, right. Became a Navy component command under it.
Yeah. SyncPOA is essentially what we call SyncPAC today.
Yeah,
Indo-PACOM.
Right? Yeah, a lot of used interchangeably and frequently incorrectly, but... Yeah, King was, a very aggressive officer, very capable, very smart, had experience in submarines early, experience in World War I, experience rescuing and salvaging submarines, went into aviation kind of late.
Johnny come lately.
Yeah, was a convert, understood the capability of aviation.
And yet he kept pressing Nimitz to use battleships.
Yeah, well, you know, even after Pearl Harbor, even, you know, the Japanese viewed their battleships as the decisive force. You know, the whole mindset for both of them was to, you know, for the U.S. to march their way across the Pacific. The Japanese, their mindset is to attrite the U.S. as they go across the Pacific using submarines, aircraft carriers, nighttime attacks with, you know, what became known as long lance torpedoes. But the battleships were going to be the decisive element. I mean, even after Pearl Harbor, both sides, Nimitz understands that one, these battleships are essentially at that time defenseless against an aircraft. That's one of the big issues at Pearl Harbor, is not so much being lack of readiness as the fact that the weapons were incapable of shooting down torpedo bombers before they drop their torpedoes, or dive bombers before they drop their bombs. You could maybe keep them from coming back a second time, which was a moot point, you know, at Pearl Harbor. And it wasn't the sailors not being ready. It wasn't, you know, 1/4 of the anti-aircraft guns at Pearl Harbor were manned and ready at the start. They were at a higher degree of readiness than normal operations. And when Nimitz took over, he didn't change Kimmel's air defense plan, because we're like, well, it's the best we got, you know. But these ships, the other thing was, they were gas hogs. They were slow. And what more important than the tanks at Pearl Harbor was the lack of tankers that constrained operations during the early part of the Pacific War. So Nimitz understood that these battleships were more of a liability. In fact, later years, Nimitz would be quoted as saying, you know, well, I won't give it the quote, but paraphrasing, you know, thank God the fleet was in port Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December and not at sea. Otherwise, all these battleships would have been sunk in deep water with most of their crews because they did not have the weapons to defend themselves against carrier aviation at the time. So, you know, anyway, so yeah, that was King's, you know, he's still locked into, you know, that's how they trained for 20 years. And by golly, that's what he wanted to do.
And what about his reported quote that when the shooting starts, they call for the sons of bitches. I think at one point I read that he, when asked about that quote, he says, I don't remember saying that, but it does sound like something I would say.
Yeah, actually what he said was, you know, the 2019 movie couldn't resist using that, even though King wouldn't have been the guy telling Nimitz to go out to, you know, Hollywood.
Yeah,
one of the 20 pages of stuff I sent to those producers that producers. He's not getting right before the movie. But anyway, he was later asked, you know, later in the war, did you actually say, is that, you know, when the tough gets going, they call for the sons of bitches. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, I didn't say that. But if I had thought of it, I would have.
Right. Okay.
That's his, you know.
Do you think that attitude, though, that, you know, personality trait was helpful or harmful to the
effort? It was ultimately harmful, you know, but, you know, it was one way to get things done. Right. I mean, one of his, you know, true quotes was that, you know, I don't care how good the staff is, you know, every 6 months you have to give them a kick in the ass. Otherwise, they'll slack off. And he could be, I mean, he was sourpuss. You know, his daughter supposedly said, well, he's the most even tempered guy I know. He's in a rage all the time.
All the time. Yeah. And one of the things we talked about earlier, though, was the public relations campaign that MacArthur was already waging at this point of the war, where the Army was winning the war in the Pacific. And, you know, King's reluctance to engage with the press and basically allowing MacArthur to control the narrative. What about that?
Well, King's quote for, you know, his press strategy was tell them nothing. When the war's over, tell them who won. Yeah, King did not want to have anything to do with the press, whereas MacArthur was all about it. And, you know, on the one hand, I can appreciate King's position. On the other, you know, it hurt. You know, we still pulled it off, but, you know, you need everything. Now, the one thing they had going for them back then that we don't have now is, you know, censorship. You know, they were able to hide the Battle of Savo Island, the Battle of Tassafaranga. The American people never understood what really happened at those battles.
Right.
End of the war, when censorship ended, they couldn't hide Indianapolis.
No, that's right.
You know, and the lack of dealing with the press during the war, once censorship came off and you had this press frenzy that accompanied the sinking of the Indianapolis, we were not prepared to deal with that. You know, King wasn't, no one was, the of a media feeding frenzy, we would call it, you know, now, because they'd been able to, you know, stiff arm them, you know, through most of the war. Mm-hmm. The press.
We're going to do a separate episode on Indianapolis, you know, entirely. And, you know, it'd be wonderful to have you on for that one as well. But, you know, again, some of the mythology that the King was protecting political people with the McVeigh court martial. What's your read on that?
You know, there's really no evidence as exactly what was motivating King or Forrestal. You know, my kind of view is that Forrestal had more to do with it than King did.
Right.
But there's no paper trail on that.
Right. Yeah.
You know, other than, like, you know, Nimitz recommended against court martial. Mm-hmm. You know, recommended a letter of reprimand, which, you know, as it turned, would have had about the same effect, but is not a conviction at court martial.
And when Nimitz was a CNO and asked about it when he was announcing McVeigh's release from house arrest, he said, well, I recommended against court martial and they didn't listen to me. And so he was confused by it as well. And that was in 1946.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising that we're confused about it in 2022.
And some of the things about, you know, King reprimanding McVeigh's, or, you know, reprimanding him early
King
for bringing
Nimitz's father reprimanding
him. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. When he was.
And, you know, King had a personally chose every, you know, because McVeigh was the in charge of the ship that was the flagship for the Fifth Fleet. Mm-hmm. King would have personally approved him going to that assignment.
That command.
And if there was a vendetta, if he had a vendetta against
he would not have
McVeigh, that would have been the time. You know, no one exactly. would have questioned that, you know.
Yeah, and by the way, King was reprimanded when he was a junior officer for coming aboard from Liberty drunk. And so he had plenty, and it wasn't McVeigh's father who reprimanded him that time. So he had plenty of that kind of dirt in his background.
Now, and yeah. Ensign Nimitz was court-martialed for running a ship aground in the Philippines in 1907.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank God he survived that.
Absolutely. Good.
Well, gentlemen, I'd like to talk more and more about this, but we're starting to run out of time here. Admiral, is there anything else you'd like to add about Hypo, Joe Rochefort, Admiral King, anything you can think of?
Any other myths you want to dispel?
Please.
No, I think we hit most of the myths. Like I say, I think the 2019 movie does a better portrayal of Station Hypo. Certainly, they get Layton really close to being right.
Right.
To me, that's the best part of the movie. Because I'm a, you know, intel officer, you know, but I mean, the impact of Station Hypo on the war was immense. Sending Rochefort to be in command of a floating dry dock was, to me, a profound injustice. He wanted to get, but on the other hand, based on what he
wanted to
do,
yeah.
They couldn't send him to a ship where he might be captured by the Japanese. So you know, he wanted a warship, but they weren't about to send him.
Well, that was a prohibition against all crypto analysts,
yeah.
right?
Is yeah.
nobody could go into the war zone where they might be captured because they'd give up
secrets.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that was, you know, porous of, you know, because Showers was Matt Shaw. You talked about him. Mm-hmm. He was actually supposed to go on the Wahoo on her last patrol.
Submarine,
and at the last instant, his boss said, no, you can't go. And the guy he replaced, what was going to replace, was actually already off the ship. So it's not, you know, but that was her, she didn't come back from that patrol. Right. And, you know, Max Showers served for many, many years in the intelligence community. I had the sad privilege, duty, to be the funeral commander for him at Arlington when he passed away in 2019. I was a senior intel officer in the Navy at the time. And so I basically butted into the Arlington thing and said, I'm going to be the funeral commander for this one. And turned out a good, you know, 100 people in uniform, including 3 stars and 2 stars marching in ranks as a tribute to him. So, I mean, he was pretty special.
Oh, yeah.
But at the time of Midway, you know, he'll tell you, I was just a new ensign. I had nothing to do with the Battle of Midway. You right. know, his claim was later in the war, he was Nimitz's, you know, current intelligence briefer. That's what got him a Bronze Star.
Yeah, he was an amazing guy. He really was. He was a very, very good man. Well, gentlemen, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. And Admiral, I want to personally thank you for being on board with us today. And I hope to do this, or I know I speak for Bill when I say I hope we can relive this relationship in several more episodes as we plod along through the Pacific War here. If that would be good with you, we'd love to have you.
Sure. I work cheap.
So do we.
So do we. on a personal note, and I just want to lay this out here, I generally don't do this, but I'm going to do it today. As you listeners may or may not have realized, these episodes are pre-recorded and as such are sometimes a couple of weeks old when they air. That being said, today's recording date is August 30th, and it is my little girl's 10th birthday. So while certainly not Pacific War related, it's an important day to me nonetheless. So happy birthday, baby. I love you. And with that, we want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcasts and give us a rating and review. We certainly would appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called The Unauthorized History of the Pacific War Podcast. Also, look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe to our page as well. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, my name is Seth Perdon. I want to say thank you, Bill.
And I want to say thank you to the Admiral. And for those of you who don't know, this Admiral Director Naval History and Heritage Command has done more, I think, to correct the historical record than any director of NHHC in history. And his impact on telling the Navy's story has been enormous.
Absolutely.
And I need to underscore that point. So thank you very much, Admiral, for continuing your wonderful contribution today.
Thank you. Take care. It's fun.
Thank you. All right, guys. We'll see you all next week. Thanks.